Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do the contents of our kitchens reveal about who we are and how we've changed? Today's supermarkets sell an amazing array of foods that might have struck our grandparents as exotic, from rices of the world to spices and flavorings harvested from every corner of the globe. And even many Americans committed to buying local are experimenting with international influence in the preparation of local produce. My guest today has observed all these changes with both curiosity and delight and reflects them back in her own work. Ruth Reichel is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Her new cookbook is called Gourmet Today. Ruth, welcome again to Think.
It is great to be here.
What does gourmet mean to people who are cooking and eating in 2009?
Well, what I hope it means is real help in the kitchen. Our job is to go out there and find everything that's good about what's going on in American food today. And there is so much that is good. You know, it's very easy to concentrate on all the bad stuff and, you know, the fact that we have an obesity crisis and that industrialized food is destroying the fiber of America. But at the same time, I've been writing about food for my entire career, and there has never been a time as exciting as this. We now have so much available to us. We have become a food culture. You know, we really, food has taken the place of movies in popular culture. It's become part of everybody's conversation. People are thinking, they're thinking about, you know, the ethics of eating, which is really changing what goes on in the American kitchen. We have this incredible farmers market movement. We have the locavore movement. We have, sustainably raised fish. People are thinking about what it means to eat fish in a time when the wild species are disappearing. We have all of this humanely raised animals. We have, you know, heritage pork and grass-fed beef. And it is, you know, for someone who has been sort of despairing about American food for such a long time, it's so exciting to see what the possibilities are today.
One thing that is really amazing, and it comes up in the book, is the idea that average grocery stores, not just the higher end ones and not just the specialty stores, have a lot more kinds of food than they used to have.
They have everything. I mean, even 5 years ago when we wrote the Gourmet Cookbook, we couldn't count on the fact that you could go to a grocery store and a supermarket and get organic produce if you wanted, that you could get things like panko, that you could get arboreal rice, that you would get Indian spice pastes, that Latino ingredients would be available to you. And now all of that is there. You know, my supermarket, I have a house in a little town in upstate New York, and I am stunned by what I can get right there in the market. I mean, an ordinary supermarket is getting produce from local farmers. That is such an amazing development. I know you guys here are very spoiled. You've got Central Market. You've been in the forefront of a lot of this here in Dallas, but it's now happening everywhere in America.
Well, and it's still a relatively recent development that it's in every neighborhood. It used to be that you might have to take a trip somewhere, but it's right there now. Do you think that that people are learning to taste in different ways than they did before?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we have a generation of kids today, and when I say kids, I mean, you know, the people who are just getting out of college, who were raised with sushi in the supermarket, who have very restless appetites, who have traveled a lot, who have encountered ethnic food in the homes of their friends, and they have a kind of curiosity that previous generations didn't. And that, I think, is a really big change, that we are much more open to new flavors than we used to be.
Is there still something that you would call American cooking that is not sort of home comfort food? Is it possible to categorize that now?
American cooking continues to change. And, you know, one of the constants is that what you would have called American cooking in 1900 was completely different in 1925 and different again in 1950. And that concept keeps changing. You know, by the 80s, American food was pizza and tacos and so forth. And today, American food includes soy sauce, a standard ingredient in every American kitchen, salsa, which now outsells ketchup. I mean, American food is an amalgam of every influence that comes into this country. And, you know, the most enormous recent change has been the Latinization of American food. I mean, as we become an increasingly Latino country, these foods, I mean, tortillas, I mean, every kitchen in America is familiar with tortillas and probably has them there.
Do you find that it's difficult to balance, particularly writing for the magazine, the people who are most interested in, for example, ethical food, with the people who really want the most delicious sauce or tomato or whatever it is, no matter where it comes from in the world? Do you have to think about that as you're putting things into words and writing about things that excite you?
We definitely have to think about it. I mean, I don't think that you can be a serious cook anymore without being a conscientious cook. I mean, I think for me, one of the really exciting things that's happened in America is that we're really starting to understand that eating is an ethical act and that our food choices have enormous consequences for not only our own health, but for the health of the planet. And if we're not ready to accept that, this younger generation is absolutely committed to making sure that we do begin to understand this. And for instance, in writing the fish chapter of Gourmet Today, we really considered the sustainability of seafood. And, you know, one of the things that we are urging people to do is don't blindly buy fish. Ask questions. Where was this fish caught? How was it caught? You know, there's a real difference between wild American shrimp, which is a very sustainable fishery and also very delicious, and the farmed shrimp that comes from much of Southeast Asia, which is an ecological disaster. And you have choices. And one of the best things that we can do as consumers is ask the places that we buy. Ask your fishmonger, where did this come from? If you see Chilean sea bass, ask them why they're carrying that. You know, do you want to be the person who eats the last Chilean sea bass on the planet? Don't you want your grandchildren to be able to eat wild fish? And if we don't ask these questions, there won't be any left for them.
Ruth Reichel is my guest. She's editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, and she has a new cookbook out called Gourmet Today. You know, that movie Julie and Julia is out, and now people are at least thinking about what it would mean to sort of cook their way through an entire book. Realistically, how do you think people use cookbooks now as compared with the way they did even 20 or 30 years ago?
Well, I think people are much more interested in food and cooking today than they were 20 or 30 years ago. And it's interesting you mentioned cooking through the book, because there were three blogs that cooked their way through the last gourmet cookbook, and there's already a blog that started out to start cooking its way through this one. And that's sort of recreational. There's also a group of people who have committed themselves starting October 1st to cook every recipe in every issue of Gourmet for the next year, which is very exciting to me. What we know, though, about cookbooks is that for the most part, people buy them and read them with great pleasure, but that the average person only uses two recipes from every cookbook.
No kidding.
Yeah. And my goal is for people to use every recipe in this cookbook and to make it so user-friendly that once you try a recipe, it's so delicious and so easy that you're inspired to cook another one. You know, we have a cookbook club at Gourmet, and one of the really shocking things to me is I have an offer to everybody on the staff except for the professional cooks. But, you know, the editors, the production people, the assistants, the art people, that we will choose 5 cookbooks a month. And anybody who wants to cook from the books, I'll pay for the ingredients. So they take them home and they write up a little report on what they've cooked. And you would not believe how many cookbooks have recipes that don't work. Really reputable writers and people come in and say, you know, there was an ingredient they didn't tell me what to do with. This recipe was terrible. We choose one book a month, and we often have trouble finding a book that everybody will say these recipes were really great. And what we do, what we've done with Gourmet Today, these recipes have been tested to literal absurdity. I mean, it's a little insane, our testing process, because when we get a perfectly wonderful result, we then say, well, how could it be better? Could we do it easier? What if we took this step out? And we do these recipes over and over and over again. I don't think there's a single recipe here that hasn't been done at least 10 times. And when it's finally done, it goes to another cook to do a cross test to make sure that the results really will come out the way we say they will.
Do you ever test them with people who aren't even sort of staff level quality cooks? In other words, people who would be those 2 recipe users?
One of the problems that we had when I first got to Gourmet, we hired a cross tester who was had been our babysitter. and he needed a job. And I said, you know, why don't you come and you can just take these recipes and you'll be the cross tester. Well, here's the problem. After 4 years,
he got really good.
He got really good, and we had to promote him to a cook. I mean, you know, he started developing recipes, and it's very, you know, you can't have that as a job description for very long because you just get too professional.
Yeah, there was a time in my life after my daughter was born where I had some time at home, and I found myself watching food shows. And it's really interesting the things that you pick up watching other people do things. Do you think that, you know, there's so much criticism of food TV, but do you think there's good technique being taught, or do you think that the basics are still glossed over a lot of times?
Well, I think that on much of food TV, it's about entertainment value. But I do think that on the internet, there's a lot of really good technique. I mean, I know at gourmet.com, we do a lot of technique videos. There's a whole video section there where people will, you know, we have 12 cooks who do nothing but develop recipes all day long. And we do videos with them, and we're not the only ones who do that. I mean, there's a lot of really good information, which, as you say, is just watching people cook, but watching people who know what they're doing cook. I mean, things like measuring flour. You know, if you don't measure flour right, your cakes don't work right.
Because you've got too much.
You've got too much.
Mm-hmm. Ruth Reichel is with us. She's editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Her new cookbook is called Gourmet Today.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Ruth Reichel. She is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine and has a new cookbook out called Gourmet Today. When I think about cooking at home, I think instantly of my grandmother, who loved to cook and was very much of her day in that almost every recipe contained a large amount of mayonnaise and some different kinds of things. But there were things she knew how to do and did on a regular basis that I don't do, making her own pasta. You know, things that you could sort of learn but that most people don't do. Are there skills that we've actually lost in moving forward into exploring more flavors and the availability of different kinds of ingredients keep us from maybe going to the essence of certain things?
I don't think that it's because there's more we've lost these. I think we've lost them because we had a whole generation that didn't cook. And there's so many people who did not grow up around people who were cooking where we've lost that easiness in the kitchen. Cooking is really easy. It's a natural It's a completely natural thing to do. It's what, you know, we're cooking animals. It's what separates us from other animals. We cook, they don't. And it's a very pleasurable activity if you're comfortable. And I think what we've lost is, you know, when you only cook a meal or two a week, it takes on a real kind of importance. So it has to be fabulous. Mm-hmm. When you're cooking all the time, sometimes it's not so good and it doesn't matter. It's just, you know.
Fills up the belly. You know, move on.
Sometimes it's, you know, it's just a meal. And I think we've lost that kind of comfortableness of just, you know, it's a meal. I'm going to try something and, you know, I hope it'll be good and if it isn't, too bad. And I think we've lost the pleasure in it. I mean, for me, I work really hard all day, and my greatest pleasure is knowing that I'm going to go home at night and stand at the stove and cook. And I love the smell of onions caramelizing and the way a knife feels when it's cutting through the onion and, you know, the smell of roasting meat or that scent of homemade chicken soup when you open up the door. Or just, I mean, sometimes I'll just, you know, bake something just because I want the aroma of butter and sugar.
Nothing that comes out of a can smell that good.
Exactly. And I think we've lost that kind of just comfort in the kitchen. And we don't have anyone to blame for that except, you know, ourselves, that we don't insist on doing it more often.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Maggie in Fort Worth. Hey, Maggie.
Hello. I'm interested in cookbooks and recipes as artifacts. Several years ago, I helped a friend proofread a new edition of his, it's the Ellis Island Immigrant Cookbook, and he had recipes that people reported their families brought through in the early 1910, 1920. Some of them are barely cookable, but when you read them, they seem very rich. When I first read this, I thought, oh, I couldn't eat this stuff. And now when I know what bad oils are out there and so many sugars, I look at this cookbook and I think these are marvelous. I wish I could figure out how to fix some of these. Some of the measurements and ingredients are kind of obscure. Have you looked at historic cookbooks or recipes like this with a new eye?
Well, it's really interesting. Even Gourmet was the first Epicurean magazine in America. It started in 1941. And if you look at the difference in the kinds of recipes that we ran and the way we wrote recipes, it changes every 10 years or so in really fascinating ways. I mean, one of the things in the old days, in the 40s, and pretty much stopped in the 50s, but we ate a lot of offal. A lot of, you find sweetbreads, livers.
Organ meats,
tripe, and a lot of game. And that just vanished. Every time we do an anniversary issue, which we do every 5 years, we talk a lot about the language of recipes. Because in the early days, our recipes took a few sentences, but they all began with, like, you know, steam one duck or skin a possum. And it was assumed that readers knew how to do that. And the recipes were sort of little guidelines because people were very comfortable using recipes. And it was just assumed that anybody who read an Epicurean magazine absolutely knew how to do that. And as time has gone on, our recipes have gotten lengthier and lengthier. It's not because they're more complicated. It's because now it might take us a whole page to tell you how to steam a duck.
I think that's helpful, though, because it's also great that I think the way that the magazine and the cookbook approach things, you'll put things in there to say, it's okay if this turns brown before it, you know, changes in this way. Or because I think sometimes we lack confidence in our ability to get to where we need to be.
Well, I mean, that's why we review our recipe writing procedure every 2 years. And, you know, thinking, you know, do we need to say this? You know, is saying until golden good enough? Do we have to say until golden about 5 minutes? Mm-hmm. And those things, they're very subtle and they change a lot. And it right now we're starting to think that maybe we can take out some of the verbiage because people are cooking again and maybe we can make the recipes a little bit shorter.
There's got to be an interesting energy around Gourmet Magazine in that everybody is so passionate about what they do, but they all share the same passion. And I wonder how often that makes it really hard to sort of think outside your own box.
Well, it is, I think, a real privilege to be around people who are all so passionate. I mean, we all go to work loving our jobs, which is, you know, I mean, that's the greatest joy that you can have. And I think we all feel really lucky about that. But we also have quite a diversity of ages, which really helps thinking outside of the box. If you have, you know, cooks who are 22 and cooks who are in their 60s, they're very different boxes that they're coming from. We also have now tried very hard to get an ethnic diversity. So we now have a Korean cook, an Italian cook. One of our food editors, which is what we call our cooks, worked with Simca Beck, who wrote the original Julia Child. He was her assistant for 10 years. We have a Mexican woman. So we have this incredible diversity in the kitchen. So again, we've got shared passion, but very different backgrounds and very different shops that they shop in. You know, I mean, our Korean cook is like, you know, shopping in Korean grocery stores, and our Mexican cook is shopping in Latino stores. And so they have this passion, but they're all bringing new ingredients all the time, which is great.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Metters in Dallas. Hi, Metters.
Hi. I just bought the Jim Laney book that you all put in the Gourmet Cookbook Club, and I just adore it, and I'm so glad that it's accessible to everybody to read and understand.
I love that book, and Jim Leahy is the guy. I mean, he is actually a guy who didn't get credit for what he did. He's the guy who gave the New York Times that no-need, very quick bread recipe, which everybody now calls Mark Bittman's or the New York Times. And it was Jim Leahy's, and he's finally come out with this book where he tells you how to make all these great breads that you don't have to knead. They're really easy. They're really wonderful. He's got an incredible pizza recipe. Now, this is one of those books that we tested, and everybody loved this book. There was no controversy about it. We all just said, we want this book.
That bread recipe actually changed me into the greatest mother ever, because my kids will like specifically ask for it, whereas before I would make bread and it would, you know, it's sort of inconsistent every time.
Yeah, and this bread is...
It's always great.
It's wonderful and easy.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We had Jacques Pepin on the show not too long ago, and he talked about when he makes a recipe, he gives it two times. He makes it twice without changing a word, without changing a single ingredient, and tastes it then and decides what he really thinks, and then feels the ability to do whatever he wants with it. Do you have a similar rule, or do you think from the beginning, you know, I really would rather have cauliflower here than broccoli, and I'm going to just go for it?
Yeah, no, we do not give it a second chance. If we all decide that it's not worth doing, we move on. Mm-hmm. Jacques, may I say, is a national treasure. We're really lucky to have him. And if he does that, maybe I should rethink this.
Well, I think everybody's got their way of approaching things. Are there things, Ruth, in your cabinet that you always have, that you know that with a few staple ingredients you can always make a meal? Are there particular spices you know will always work?
Well, you know, everybody has spices that are their particular favorites. And it's really interesting. At the magazine, we start to learn. You know, I have one cook who adores cumin, and I, you know, keep saying, you know, do we have to have cumin in everything? You know, I am really fond of basil. I took an Indian cooking class recently for our new TV show and fell in love with curry leaves, and now I feel like I will never be without curry leaves. I love chilies of all kinds, so I always have a lot of chilies, and I always have dried habanero pepper flakes in my cupboard. I love the flavor of both cardamom and coriander, and they're two spices I wouldn't want to be without. But of course, I also, you know, my go-to ingredients are, I am never without Parmesan cheese, which I think is just, you know, absolutely improves everything. And you can, if you need cheese, you can always substitute Parmesan, and you can use even the rind. It enriches stocks. I mean, it's just an incredible ingredient. I'm never without lemons. I love sweet butter. I would never want to open up my refrigerator and not find some sweet butter in there. Eggs, I think, you know, if you have eggs in your refrigerator, and a little bacon and some dried pasta, you always have, you know, spaghetti carbonara is sitting there waiting to become dinner. I think that I have recently started always having miso, which is an incredible umami power ingredient, and I add it to things that are not remotely Asian. You know, a little bit in a stew just really brings the flavor up. I like oyster sauce. It's, you know, makes a very instant stir fry for vegetables, another real power ingredient. Artisanal soy sauce, good balsamic vinegar, olive oil.
Artisanal soy sauce. I didn't know there was anything other than what you sort of buy in the standard glass jar.
No, there is. Increasingly, you can find, now even in the United States, someone is making it. But the difference between, you know, really artisanally made soy sauce and commercial soy sauce is pretty powerful. And, you know, it's expensive, but it lasts a long time. And, you know, one of the things I love about the way we're thinking about ingredients, for instance, in Gourmet Today, we have a recipe for cooking black beans. And it's dried black beans, but we include a little bit of soy sauce, a little bit of balsamic vinegar, and a little bit of sherry. And suddenly the flavor it's so much richer and more delicious.
Ruth Reichel is my guest. Her new book is called Gourmet Today. Let's go next to Oscar in Richardson. Hello, Oscar.
Hi. A quick question about the liver. I used to cook a recipe with caramelized onion, turmeric, and chicken liver.
And sounds great.
Because I was worrying how healthy it is for you, and I don't eat it no more because of that.
Well, you know, it depends whose livers you're buying. If you buy livers from, you know, free-range animals. It's really interesting. I buy my chickens from a farmer who lives next door to me upstate, and they have free-range chickens. And the difference in those chicken livers and the commercial chicken livers, I mean, just you can see with your naked eye how much better they are. And, you know, I do think livers are something you want to think about because they are the filters for the animal systems, and it would be wise to buy, you know, organically raised, you know, well well-treated animals. And if you do that, you should have no problem.
Do you actually slaughter your own chickens?
I do not. I do not. I wish I could say I did, but no.
One of those things you can leave to someone else.
Yes.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email from Joe who says, I've subscribed to Gourmet since 1952.
Ooh.
And I remember
we love you, Joe.
That they had one of those subscription cards that offered you a lifetime subscription for $100. Had I had the money, I would have done it. What a bargain that was.
We actually still have a few people who got the lifetime subscription when the magazine first started. There aren't very many of them. I think it was only $50 in 1941. Mm-hmm. Yes, a $50 lifetime subscription would have been a great bargain.
What kinds of tools do you find lacking in the average kitchen that ought to be there? And then are there extraneous things that people end up spending a lot of money on that they don't use?
Well, you know, I am not a gadget person. I'm constantly thinking that the best cooking I did in my life was when I was really poor and had no gadgets at all. In fact, didn't even have a rolling pin, used a bottle of wine to roll out the dough. And I think that people get stopped by thinking that they can't cook unless they have perfect pans. And, you know, it's really nice to have good pans, but you can do without.
Ruth Reichel is my guest. She's editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Her new book is called Gourmet Today.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can enrich your life and your career with hundreds of non-credit courses. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine, Ruth Reichel. Her new cookbook is called Gourmet Today. You, as I understand it, wrote to President and Mrs. Obama after the election and said, maybe it's time to rethink the executive chef in the White House.
Well, I didn't do it by myself. It was Alice Waters, Danny Meyer, and myself who really thought that the President and the First Lady should put food at the top of their agenda. And we did not anticipate that they would do so wonderfully so quickly. And, you know, we were sort of starting small and thinking, you know, the way that you eat is really, it could have a huge impact on the rest of the nation. And, you know, the First Lady very wisely, I think, decided that she didn't want to make a huge change in the kitchen, although she had sort of very quietly had this our dream chef, actually, someone who had worked in soup kitchens and wanted to do organics and so forth, who had been feeding their family for a long time. And she sort of snuck him in the back door of the kitchen. But very publicly, you know, put this garden into the White House and just recently set up a farmer's market just down the street from the White House. And they have been wonderful, I think, in influencing food choices in America. And so, you know, our suggestion was sort of a small one, you know, get a great chef in the White House. And actually, one of the things that I was hoping they would do, and I still hope that they would do, is set up a press office in the White House kitchen and send out weekly recipes for healthy food from the White House. I think that, you know, kids all over America would want to eat what Sasha and Malia are eating, and I know they eat healthy food, and I think that it would go a long way toward helping this obesity crisis that we've got.
Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we'll speak with William in Fort Worth. Hey, William.
Hi, this is William. I'm calling from Fort Worth, and first-time caller, I had a question. I'm interested in eating healthy, and I've run into two problems. One, the cost of food in lots of the recipes, and two, I really don't have the time to do all of the prep. It takes an hour to make a gourmet meal, so do you have suggestions in your book that would be for healthy quick meals? Or do you have examples right now?
Absolutely. We have lots of – I mean, this cookbook has almost 1,100 recipes in it, and half of them can be done in under half an hour. So the notion that it takes a lot of time to make good food is nonsense. There are also – I mean, one of the big expenses in American food is meat. And we found that if you're feeding anyone under the age of 25 in America today, you have to start thinking about vegetarian food. My son, you know, every time he brings a friend home from college, they turn out to be vegetarian. There are 100 and some main course vegetarian dishes in this book, and lots of suggestions for shortcuts, how to do it, how to, you know, cook a pot of beans at the beginning of the week that you can use as the week goes on. Lots of suggestions for inexpensive cuts for things to do with chicken. I think that the notion that, you know, healthy, good food has to be expensive and time-consuming is it's a lie that we have been sold. It's just not true. And it's part of what we set out to dispel that myth in this book. And, you know, the book has really taken a lot of the fat out of food. We get flavor from other places. And it really does tell you how to deal with all of the new produce and grains and beans that appear in the marketplace, which are excellent meat substitutes.
On the other hand, you know, if you look at certain parts of the world where people are either required to or willingly spending a greater percentage of their income on food, those are often the places where food seems to be better and more valued than it is here. You know, you look at Europe where it doesn't seem so odd for people to pay really good money for particular things. Do you think that we – is price too much an object? I mean, I know people are trying to live on a budget, but do we need to rethink how much – of our paychecks is an appropriate amount to spend on what we eat?
Well, I think for those of for people who can afford food, we have the cheapest food in the world, and I do think we have to rethink the place of food in our budgets. But you know, we're in a time right now where there are a lot of people in this country who are really suffering, and it's very hard to say to someone who is struggling to feed a family on a very limited budget, "Oh, come on, food is cheap." And you know, one of the real problems that we have is that our tax structure makes junk food cheaper than food.
Processed food.
Processed food. And, you know, that is something that we have to change on a national level. It is ridiculous that you can go out and get a hamburger in a fast food place that's cheaper than a salad. And it's not natural, but it has to do with our tax structure. And, you know, that's a place where I think we have to ask our government to make changes to support family farmers and so forth.
Let's go next to Vicky in Grapevine. Hey, Vicky.
Hey.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. This is totally off the subject of your new book, but I'm an avid barbecue fan, and I read in Texas Monthly Barbecue Magazine section the last time a review that you gave of City Market Barbecue in Luling, which you described gloriously in words that I have always felt but have never been able to duplicate. And I wondered if you still felt the same way, had the same warm fuzzies for City Market in Luling.
I do. You know, the first time that I went there, I had one of those epiphanies, and I sat there eating that food and thinking, I have found food nirvana. I mean, it's one of those really cherished food memories for me. It was like where I learned what barbecue could really be. And I thought, I've just never had good barbecue before. I thought I knew what I was eating, and this is just, it's transcendent. And I absolutely still feel that way.
What's the relationship between the kinds of foods that we experience when we eat out and what happens in our own kitchens? Is there a disconnect, or do we bring those things home?
Well, I think that's a great question because, you know, restaurant chefs have very much led the way in this food revolution. They've, you know, it was they who went out and got farmers to start growing real strawberries at a time when you could only get cotton strawberries in the United States. And they sort of spearheaded the whole green market movement. And they're the ones who introduce us to new flavors. At the same time, the notion that there are people all over America who think they ought to be able to cook restaurant quality food is one of the reasons that people are afraid of cooking. We are not, most of us are not trained restaurant chefs, and we shouldn't be trying to do things that have 3,000 steps and 50, you know, minor little recipes that come up to make one big dish. Home cooking is very different than restaurant cooking, and that's a good thing. And we need to recognize that. And we shouldn't be trying to do extremely complicated recipes.
We have an email here from Melissa who says, years ago, I read an editor's note that Ruth had written in which she talked about enjoying preparing food and eating food and not worrying about watching each bite she consumed with an eye on her weight. That letter inspired me. I am passionate about cooking and am now as fit as I have ever been.
Oh, good. Thank you. Because I do think that one of the things that happens is we don't pay attention to our own appetites enough. And if you let that little voice in the back of your head that says, I shouldn't eat this, I shouldn't eat this, if you let go of that and just start paying attention to, you know, the point when you've had enough, you don't really have to worry about weight. You know, as someone who was a restaurant critic for almost 30 years, it was very instructive. Knowing that there was always another great meal coming, I stopped gobbling up everything on my plate.
We'll go next to Patricia in Dallas. Hey, Patricia.
Hey, thank you for letting me talk to Ruth.
Sure.
In 1978, we started doing your Thanksgiving meal, and we started, and we have continued. Our kids have grown up with that. They hated sushi for a Thanksgiving dinner, and they kept saying, why can't we have Thanksgiving like everybody else? But now they're the appetizer group. Everybody brings something different. We have had more laps, more competition, more fun in the kitchen. This kitchen is a zoo before we put food on the table. It has been so much fun. Thank you.
That sounds wonderful.
Thank you.
Do you, when she said gourmet Thanksgiving, I'm guessing that she's talking about just taking recipes from the magazine, or do you do an edition every year where you say, throw out the turkey and do this?
No, I mean, we actually do at least three Thanksgivings every year now. I mean, this year we're doing an incredible Southern Thanksgiving, an incredible Pennsylvania Dutch Thanksgiving, and a vegetarian Thanksgiving. So we're giving you very many options. I love Thanksgiving. I love this meal that, you know, everybody in America thinks that we all sit down to the same meal, and everybody in America takes that meal and makes it their own. And there's something just wonderful about knowing that on this one day, we've all taken this kind of classic meal and embraced it and put our own touch on it. And it's my favorite holiday.
Well, what's so interesting about that idea is that there are a couple of different ways that people can use food. They use it to feed themselves and their families. But a lot of people also consider what they cook to sort of tell a story about themselves and who they are. Do you Do you consider that? Does that play into the way you write about food?
Well, you know, I've always thought that food choices can tell you everything about people, and that even unconsciously, we use food the way we use handwriting as a way of telling the world, this is who I am. And that is sort of the cornerstone of how I write about food is, you know, for me, food is a way of making sense of the world. And most of us really unconsciously recognize that.
I think we have time for one more phone call. We will talk to Andrew in Fort Worth. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I had a question about the new cookbook and a comment. The wonderful show today. I've attended many different types of cooking classes, and they all seem to be recipe-based, and the only one that I've ever attended that was really superb was the Peter Kump School in New York, where they really taught technique. And I was wondering if any sections of the new book focus on technique, and if there's any new sort of newness to any techniques that are out there that might be mentioned in the book.
This is not primarily a technique book. This is a recipe book. I mean, we give you lots of tips. I mean, there are lots of things like, you know, one of the things we discovered is that people aren't just using regular salt anymore, and that people don't understand that you can't substitute kosher salt teaspoon for teaspoon for, you know, the kind of salt that everybody used to have just sitting next to their stove. And so we have lots of things like that and tips on, how to make your own ricotta. And the book is filled. There's a big section on vegetables, and every vegetable we tell you how to buy it, how to store it, and the simplest possible way to cook it. You know, in addition to a few recipes, there's also just, you know, how to steam, how to roast, etc., each vegetable. But this is not a picture book with, you know, step-by-step techniques in it.
Do you have a favorite, in the last 10 seconds, is there a favorite book that you would recommend for people who need technique help?
Well, you know, Jacques Pepin put out that classic book called La Technique, and it's really good.
Ruth Reichel is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Her new cookbook is called Gourmet Today. Ruth, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.